I'm Marty Moscow, and welcome to The Connection. Psychotherapist Esther Perel has helped us understand the underlying motivations and drives in our relationships with our intimate partners. Her best-selling 2013 book, Mating in Captivity, Unlocking Erotic Intelligence, explored the tension between domesticity and sexual desire in long-term relationships and how to have both. That was followed by The State of Affairs, Rethinking Infidelity, also a bestseller, about the complexities of betrayal and how healing from an affair can lead a couple to a deeper, more honest relationship. Her podcast, Where Should We Begin?, features real couples working with Perel as they struggle with their conflicts. And there's more, including an 8-city tour, an evening with Esther Perel, the future of relationships, love, and desire, which begins on April 4th at the Met here in Philadelphia. Esther Perel was born in Belgium and is the daughter of Holocaust survivors, something that has inspired her as a therapist and as a human being. We have invited Esther Perel to join us today to talk about sustaining meaningful intimate connections while living in a time of conflict, anxiety, and upheaval. Esther Perel, nice to have you with us today on The Connection.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, let me begin big. We are in an epidemic of loneliness. There's political anger and mistrust. There is pessimism about the future, including things like wars and climate change. I think there's a hangover from the pandemic. Many people in this country believe in lies and liars and conspiracy theories. Is this country having a kind of nervous breakdown from your perspective?
Wow, nervous breakdowns come in many forms.
They do.
I think that what we see at this moment is a confluence of a few big things having to do with despair, having to do with modern loneliness, having to do with an increasing social atrophy, and having to do with polarization. So I don't know that I can answer them all at once, but if we start with modern loneliness, probably because it's the most visceral on a human level, sure, is how basically it masks itself as hyperconnectivity. We can be talking to 1,000 virtual friends online and have nobody to ask to feed our cats. We can be in situations with people who are telling us some very important personal things while we are ticking away at the phone and we are answering them with this uh-huh that lets them know that we may be there, but we are certainly not present. And that induces for many of us what has come to be called ambiguous loss, like the person is physically present but psychologically absent, like in Alzheimer's for that matter. Sure. And we have this experience of artificial intimacy where we should be satiated, we should feel nurtured, and we're not. So that's one side of the experience. We experience a lot of things alone that we should not be experiencing alone, that are actually collective experiences that everybody goes through. But the rise of individualism has brought us to being quite disconnected on matters that we really would do much better if we were sharing the experience with others. Then there is polarization, then there is war and the climate crisis, and so we can plunge into those as we move along.
Well, indeed, and those are all important, and I'm glad you raised them. But I wonder too, and again, I'm speaking broadly about us human beings, that how we react to anxiety or being afraid or change. Are you worried about the appeal of even dictators or our loss of the ability to know what's true and what isn't true? There's so much noise that reality can get lost in this very complicated and busy and very reactive world that we live in.
So, you know, I'll answer this in two ways. The philosopher Hannah Arendt made a very strong point when she said that social isolation, that being disconnected, that being in a situation where you cannot have conversations with people who you disagree with is the best fertile ground for the rise of totalitarianism. Totalitarianism offers you one singular story with a singular truth, and it has the pseudo capacity of actually bringing you together in creating a kind of a shared narrative rather than the fraction of polarization. Polarization is something that, as a therapist, a couples therapist in particular, I know a lot about. Interestingly, you know, if you watch for decades couples that are in a standoff, you know, blaming each other, attacking each other, counterattacking, responding defensively, throwing it back onto the other with an instant reactivity cycle that escalates from a 0 to 100, you begin to see how polarization works. Each person projecting onto the other the extreme version of themselves and the stuff that they can't tolerate themselves. So we begin to see that people find a kind of a refuge in extremes, because there you don't have to hold complexity. And politics, society, relationships, marriage, those are complex systems where often a problem is not resolved by right and wrong, but by holding the contradiction, by holding the duality and the complexity, because there are no easy solutions. Whether it is small subjects, smaller subjects like school lunches or biking lanes, or big subjects like the climate crisis or Israel-Palestine or the Ukraine war, all of that, what we really see is a pull towards the extremes, with each basically completely each side disqualifying the other side, to the point of dehumanization, to the point of you have no right to live, or you have no right to exist, or and basically fracturing the world ever more. I see it in a micro setting in my office, but I think that the dynamic is not that different if you go larger groups. Recently, I did a conversation with people who do international peace negotiations together with people who work in group relations in the United States, and then me as a couples therapist. And we agreed on one thing. Polarization is less about the subject and more about the form. All polarizations have the same form, be the matter personal, private, or international. And that, you know, inability to hold the complexity and to simplify the position of the other, to attribute complexity to ourselves, but to make the other side simple and negate all validity of it, is a property of what is happening in our world at this moment, well, including in this.
Yes, indeed. And just to boil it down to one word, which is the ability to listen to that other person, and how hard it is when we feel so polarized and so upset and so angry.
When you are polarized, you experience listening as agreeing. You experience listening as validating what you have already decided is the lack of validity of anything that the other side could be saying. You forget that when you listen, you are not just the recipient of something, but the quality of listening is actually what creates the quality of the speaker. If you listen with a certain ear, you invite the speaker to speak differently. The listener creates the speaker, and the speaker creates the listener. These things are interdependent, but we don't live as if it's like that.
Indeed. You have said, and I think just what we hear from you so far, is that the quality of our relationships define the quality of our life. And you've been talking about just the stresses on having relationships with other people, including things like social media. But do you think it is harder to have a quality relationship today than it was a generation or two ago?
That's a very good question. Look, relationships have never been simple. And even when people lived more in communities and in extended families, they were filled with strife, with competitions, with brothers who didn't talk to each other for their entire life, with daughters who were exiled from the family because their behavior was not approved of. So I would not romanticize. I think A few things have changed. You know, a question I like to ask a lot in my public speaking is, how many of you grew up playing freely on the street? Because, and then how many of you have kids or would let your kids today play freely on the street? And of course, we're going pretty much from 10 to 2. And what I'm saying is, when we were playing and we had unmonitored, unscripted, unchoreographed social negotiation with people from the neighborhood, we learned to fight, to make up, to compete, to manipulate, to repair, to make groups, to change groups. We had a host of experience in social negotiation, and we are losing a lot of that practice. We also come out of 2 years of lockdown. We are also, many of us, working remote. Basically, we are living in a gradually growing contactless world in which you don't have to go out of your house, neither to exercise, neither to eat, for not, just or neither to see people. And so this social atrophy, I do think, is influencing the way we handle relationships. And the more virtualized we become and the more we live in fantasy worlds, the less prepared we will be to relate to human beings around us. Very simple. You sit on a New York City subway, city subway, and you see that 9 out of 10 people are not lifting their head during their entire ride. You know, what do you do when somebody is attacked? Do you even notice it? Do you think other people will notice it for you? Or are you actually plugged in and you don't even see what's around you? So I think that there is something fundamental that is shifting. And I don't know yet where it is taking us, but we have morphed many times in history as a species. And maybe this is one new transition.
And we're almost up in a break here. What you're describing is this sort of lack of literally physical human contact, a kind of marasmus, you know, like a failure to thrive. Is it that dangerous? And about 30 seconds before our first break here.
Yeah. I mean, we are embodied creatures. We have senses. It makes a difference when we smell each other, when we touch each other for real, when we hold each other when we are in sorrow, when we lift each other when we are in joy. And that basic human connection, I think, is at the center of our essence.
Well, you are listening to The Connection here on WHYY in Philadelphia. And our guest today on the show is Esther Perel. You have probably heard of her because she has two well-watched TED Talks. And she's also written two best-selling books. And she is a busy person and busy therapist, traveling the country, talking with people. And she's got a tour coming up as well. We've got much more to talk about after this very short break. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.
Here at Shortwave Space Camp, we escape our everyday lives to explore the mysteries and quirks of the universe. We find weird, fun, interesting stories that explain how the cosmos is partying all around us. From stars to dwarf planets to black holes and beyond, we've got you. Listen now to the Shortwave podcast from NPR.
You're listening to The Connection here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with psychotherapist Esther Perel about a whole host of things, including the loneliness epidemic in our country, how life has changed in so many different ways. And I do want to talk with you, Esther, about how marriage has changed. And you have said that it has really moved from a much more sort of practical financial arrangement to one that's really built around love and emotions and finding someone who will fulfill all our expectations and give us the happiness that we crave. So is marriage sagging under the weight of all these responsibilities and expectations? Seems like a lot, doesn't it?
There is more, actually. I mean, one way that I think we can look at the progression of marriage is to say it used to be a production economy. Hmm. for family life, for procreation, children, economic support, social status. Then it became a service economy for affection, for intimacy, for connection, for sexuality. And now it's become an identity economy in which I'm going to choose you or you will choose me and we will help each other become the best version of ourselves. So we keep mounting Mount Olympus. And as Eli Finkel says, when you reach the top, the view is really beautiful. Those of us who succeed in creating that have a magnificent view at the top. But many of us don't succeed in climbing the mountain altogether. So are we asking too much? We are asking today in marriage for one person to give us what once an entire village used to provide. Mm. In the United States, marriage is often a welfare state of two. And on top of it, we want a best friend and a trusted confidant and a passionate lover and a co-parent and an intellectual equal, et cetera, et cetera. And we are much more isolated. This is the first time in the history of marriage where the survival of the family depends on the happiness of the couple. There's nothing else holding the couple together than how content are they to be with each other. And if they're not, then the family dissolves. So we've never invested more in love. And we've never divorced more in the name of love.
That's so moving and fascinating at the same time. Going back to your original book, Mating in Captivity, really, which was about this paradox, this tension, especially in long-term relationships, this desire for closeness and this need for freedom, the sort of domesticity and desire roller coaster or collision course. Is it possible to have both? How do we reconcile those two, what feels like competing needs and desires?
So we all have a need for security, safety, stability, dependability, you know, for the grounding forces of life. We all do. But we also all have a need for freedom, for change, for novelty, for exploration, discovery, risk. Some of us more one than the other. Some stages more one than the other. Every one of us will come out of our childhood, sometimes needing more protection and connection, and some of us needing more space and individuality. And we, of course, will often partner with someone whose proclivities will match our vulnerabilities. These are not opposing forces. These are two sets of fundamental human needs that pull us sometimes in different directions and spring from different forces. And we have always tried to reconcile them, but not necessarily in one relationship. That's what is new. We want the same person to give us novelty and familiarity, or to give us mystery and surprise and routine. And that is where we became to ask something that is quite new, an experiment in the history of humankind. How do we keep them together? You know, if you really want to be in a relationship where you have no surprise, I mean, let's put it this way. For some of us, finding this kind of stability and security and reliance with one person is more than we've ever had our whole life. Not everybody wants both. Some of us know in advance when we meet someone if what we are looking for. Sometimes we know it consciously, sometimes we don't know it consciously, but that doesn't mean we don't know it. And it is not a problem that you solve to reconcile these two things, love and desire. It's a paradox that you manage. You make sure that you don't just become complacent and mired in routine. You know, like in any other aspect of your life, your professional life, your friendships, your artistic pursuits, that you need to bring in novelty, that you want to take some risks that allow you to discover something new, because that novelty is generative, it breeds testosterone, and it creates aliveness. Everybody knows the difference between a relationship that is not dead and is surviving versus a relationship that is alive and thriving. Everyone knows it in the relationship with their partner or a friendship or a job. We know that distinction. We know when we're gasping and we know when we are savoring.
Is it helpful if we want both those things, domesticity or security and desire, to think of a long-term relationship as a kind of extended date? I mean, is that helpful at all?
It's a beautiful image. It's a beautiful image. It's also, you know, everybody who's ever seen a little kid play, the kid sits on your lap. They experience domesticity, so to speak, connection. They're nested, they're secure, they're safe. And at some point, they jump off and they go and they run into the world to play, to discover, and to engage in their own imaginative fervor. So we actually know this. We know that Ulysses is about home and journey and travel. Mm-hmm. We always, every epic story has told the roots and the discovery, the familiar and the novel, the exploration and the recognition. If we like the image of a date, because in a date we invest, we bring our imagination, we are playful, we are curious, then these are absolutely the ingredients of aliveness, what we call erotic intelligence.
Well, in fact, the subtitle to Mating in Captivity is about erotic intelligence. Let me move on to your other book, because I think it's related to what we're talking about, State of Affairs. Does that explain then the appeal of affairs? Because there is the excitement and the discovery and the play and the danger and all the things that you might not be getting at home.
Affairs is a very complex subject, and there are many different reasons for why they happen. But yes, if I, and I'm going to say something, and that absolutely doesn't mean I condone or approve or encourage any of that. But I did spend 10 years researching affairs across the world. And one word that many people who were in affairs were using, the word I heard the most was, "I feel alive." Hmm. It wasn't about sex and it wasn't about excitement. It was, "I feel alive. I'm reconnecting to parts of myself. I feel somebody's listening to me with a different attention. I am listening with a different attention." Yes, an affair is an erotic plot, so to speak. And when I say erotic, I'm not talking about a repertoire of sexual techniques or urges. I am talking about the experience of aliveness, vibrancy, and vitality. It is, and I'm talking about affairs. I'm not talking about the multitudes of ways people can cheat. Sure. This is very specific. But for many people, affairs are described as an erotic plot. It wasn't so much that I wanted to leave the person I was with. I wanted to leave the person I had myself become. I wanted to reconnect with lost parts of myself. I mean, affairs are about lying and duplicity and betrayal, and they are also about yearning and loss.
I wonder, too, whether the person who is having the affair, as you say, alive was the word you kept hearing over and over again, whether it's really about them falling in love with themselves again, because they are experiencing a different part of themselves that they might not feel in a more sort of committed long-term relationship.
Yep. It's definitely something that I heard a lot. It's not that I wanted to find a new partner. I wanted to find a new self or an old self. So it's often less about the relationship. We tend to think that affairs are symptoms of relationships gone awry, and that they are, by definition, reactions to what's happening in the relationship. And that is absolutely there. But there's a whole other group of affairs that are much more individual, that are actually things that are happening inside and have nothing to do, and happen in very good relationships, where a person lost something. There is grief. You know, one of the things that was very interesting also to find out is how many affairs take place in the immediate aftermath of death and loss.
Oh, wow. Wow. That's fascinating. Trying to reclaim something?
Reclaim something, the life unlived, the need to feel alive, an antidote to death. Things like that. And again, I'm not saying this to make something that is deeply, deeply painful and a deep betrayal justified, but I understood that there is a story around affairs that is about the meaning of the affair itself rather than just the facts.
Let me just quickly I'm sorry, let me just quickly reintroduce you. And that's a psychotherapist, Esther Perel, joining us today on The Connection, talking with one of the most respected and one of the most popular psychotherapists working today. And we've been talking about a whole host of things, focusing now on affairs. And again, she wrote a book about affairs called State of Affairs. And Esther, just picking up on what you were just saying there, for the couple, though, and perhaps the person who was not having the affair, it is about sex and betrayal and lies. How do you get past that?
What you're highlighting here is that affairs are often it's two perspectives. What it did to you, which is the betrayal, the lying, the duplicity, the cheating, the gaslighting even, and what it meant for me. And it's really part of how you get past it is by being able to follow both of these tracks. What it did to you means that I have to be able to acknowledge what I did, to be accountable, to take responsibility, to not justify, and to show proper guilt and remorse for what it did to you. That's stage one. Then in stage two, it becomes important to understand what did this mean for you so that I understand why this happened. This may have had nothing to do with me, actually. That helps. Doesn't change the feeling of betrayal, but it helps to understand why did this happen? Why now? What was all of this about? And where did I feature in this story at that time? And did you think about me and our family and our children and your friends and our life? And can you know, the question you always ask is, why would people risk losing everything for a glimmer of what? I mean, this thing doesn't just come out of nowhere. So if people, and people lose sometimes everything they build for decades, for what? And the what is not sex. That we understand, you know? So then what is this what? What is its meaning? That is the next piece that is very important. And then some couples will indeed be couples who were jolted out of complacency and the affair is an alarm system and it awakens them and they realize that what they want is this relationship to live and thrive and they reinvest. Others realize that they were dying on the vine and that this is the fatal blow and it just brought an end to something that was already dead. And others end up telling you, but not immediately, that this hard period that was the hardest period of their life has actually produced a more honest, deeper, and intimate relationship that they never had before. They wish it didn't have to happen this way, but they understand that it produced something that they could not have imagined. So you have three main types of outcomes, actually.
Let me quote you, if I can, Esther Perel, from The State of Affairs. But this is for our listeners. And I think it's, first of all, I think it's beautifully written. And it really underscores what you're saying. And you write, infidelity brings us face to face with the volatile and opposing forces of passion, the lure, the lust, the urgency, the love and its impossibility, the relief, the entrapment, the guilt, the heartbreak, the sinfulness, the surveillance, the madness of suspicion, the murderous urge to get even, the tragic denouement. But be forewarned, addressing these issues requires a willingness to descend into a labyrinth of irrational forces. Love is messy, infidelity more so, but it is also a window like no other into the crevices of the human heart. And I think that's, I mean, sort of says everything there, but I wanted to read that because I think it just underscores all the things that are sort of roiling under the surface, especially with this crisis within a relationship.
You know, when I listen to you read it, I think I realize why I write books and why sometimes speaking cannot match it. It takes a while to create that sentence. And I poured myself in it, and I realized that I have nothing to add now that could say it better than I would.
Well, there you go. But I was happy to read that. Well, let me ask you then about, I guess, if I can frame it, the difference between secrecy and privacy. And if secrets, I mean, are secrets always dangerous and toxic, or is there a place for secrets in a healthy, happy relationship?
When a child says to their friend, let's go and get some ice cream.
Right. Right.
We don't tell anybody. You know, we all get that there are situations where secrecy is alluring and it creates a sense of freedom and it creates a sense of toppling of authority and hierarchy. We know we have had secrets from our teachers, secrets from the babysitters, secrets from the camp counselors. I mean, there is a world of secrecy, including the secret that a couple may have, you know, from the people around them, that creates a boundary, that creates something that is unique, special between us. And then there is another world of secrecy that is intergenerational. Affairs are often intergenerational secrets. Affairs are systemic. You know, they're not just affecting two people. Because sometimes even when the affair is revealed, then the person who was the victim of the affair doesn't tell other people because now they have the secret over the secret. I mean, so what is a secret? A secret is when it grows as a mushroom in the midst of a relational system, a negative secret, right? And if I can't tell you where I was between 2 and 4, slowly, I stop telling you where I was between 10 and 12. If I don't tell you this, then I begin to make sure that all the things around it are also protected in case we would come too close to the heart of the matter. And so I create opaqueness. And now, so what you see with secrets is they create an opacity, they grow, they become pernicious. They travel, they enter the body of others who experience all kinds of weird symptoms and have no idea why until one day they find out that there was another child that died before them, but nobody ever told them that.
Those are big secrets. We're almost up in a break here, but like little secrets, are they less dangerous and pernicious?
Yes, of course. Secrets have a gradation. You know, and sometimes it depends who they're being held from. You know, the mother who knows things about the child that the father doesn't know, or the other mother doesn't know. I think that secrets are highly contextual. What is the difference between privacy and secrecy is that in pri that A, sometimes we disagree. Well, I think that the fact that, you know, I satisfy myself sexually, that's a big secret in many relationships, you know, is actually an act of privacy, and somebody else thinks that it's a secrecy. Why did you never tell me? Well, why should I? This is between me and me. So that's a classic example in an intimate relationship. Why don't you tell me what you've told your friend or what your friend told me you? Because my friend talks to me, and when my friend talks to me, I understand that it's just me, and that doesn't mean it becomes a couple's information.
Well, I'll tell you what, hold on to that thought only because they're playing my song. We have to take a very short break and we'll get back to our conversation with psychotherapist Esther Perel. We'll be right back.
Here at Shortwave Space Camp, we escape our everyday lives to explore the mysteries and quirks of the universe. We find weird, fun, interesting stories that explain how the cosmos is partying all around us. From stars to dwarf planets to black holes and beyond, we've got you. Listen now to the Shortwave podcast from NPR.
You're listening to The Connection here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. And if you're just joining us, I'm talking with Esther Perel, one of the most well-known psychotherapists working today. She has a couple of TED Talks, a couple of books, Mating in Captivity, The State of Affairs. She also has a popular podcast called Where Should We Begin? I want to pick up on something that you just referenced about intergenerational affairs. And I wanted to ask you about the power of our, I guess, our childhoods, our relationship with our parents to create the people that we are as adults. And I wonder even whether we have a kind of invisible loyalty to family members that we might never have met, grandparents that we might never have met, and yet somehow their lives are influencing our lives.
Right. It's actually So there's two parts here. One is about what is the power of intergenerational secrets, and the other one is simply what is the influence of our family of origin, and how many generations back do we go when we use the word family of origin? In the West, we tend to think in three generation terms. But in many other parts of the world, when we talk about our ancestors, it is much bigger. Modern psychology, Western psychology, that is very individualistic, thinks of, our family of origin as the source for the problems, the conflicts, the challenges, the aspirations, the anxieties that we face as adults. And often it's the parents who are alive or the parents who are no longer there. But it is we, and on occasion we may think about the grandparents, especially if they were the ones who raised us. But we're talking about the influence of the people who raised us on our psychological well-being at this moment. Many cultures are talking about spirits, other forces, ancestors who express themselves not in direct linear ways, and yet they influence what's happening in your body, your dreams at night, who you're coming across, what's happening to your child. It's a lot more diffuse and much deeper in terms of intergeneration. And I think that it's very important for us to make that distinction. It's a construct. Nobody can totally prove this, but we're proving it all the time because we have the premise set up front. We believe that this is so. We believe that childhood is often a series of things of which we either got too much of something or too little of something. We got too much attention. We got intrusive attention. We got attention that was really harmful, or we get not enough attention and we got neglect and deprivation. And it makes a lot of sense, but it I think sometimes it's too narrow, and that this needs to be seen also on a collective level, on a societal level, not just on a singular family level.
Well, I know one of the questions that you ask couples is, how did you come to think this way? And I guess,
Yes.
so much of our childhood can influence how we think about ourselves, about our intimate partners, about the world that we live in, about just about everything that we experience.
Where should we begin the podcast was my attempt to open the doors of my clinical practice, which I still have, because I felt that so many conversations that are happening behind the closed door should actually happen in the public space. That a lot of these experiences that we go through alone, including pertaining to trauma or the effects of secrecy, or loneliness, or polarization, or cut off from family members, or the effects of war, or refugee status, or disasters, natural disasters, all the big things that people bring in the office, are they really material for psychotherapy in a closed door? Or should they actually also be conversations in the wide? And that's when I began to do the podcast. The people on the podcast are never patients, but you're listening in like a fly on the wall to sessions of other couples and individuals. And the more attentively you listen to them, and the more you see yourself, and you identify with the story, with the background of all these people. Relationships are stories. And so you hear how people create their stories and how they make them up. I, of course, have come to think the way I do because of my story and because of the way that I tell my story. So there is what happened to me, and then there is what I did with it. That's what everybody does. And then there is the parts of what I did with it that were very helpful. And then there is the parts where I got stuck in my story. And we are all getting stuck in our stories sometimes. And then my work is to help you come up with new stories, to edit well, to write often, and to become more of the author of your story, so you don't have the feeling that you're just living out predetermined, predestined things for upon which you have very little control.
And I do want to actually pick up on your story, but I do have a follow-up question about being a therapist. I think I know the answer to this. Do people take advice? I mean, your therapy, as you described, is about people reclaiming and perhaps rewriting their stories. Is there something about, and there's a lot of advice out there, a lot of self-help out there. Is there something that doesn't work about advice?
Yes. Yes, I will say this. I spoke yesterday with a sociologist who was telling me that humanities are totally in decline. But what is the only department that is actually thriving is the psychology department. I thought that was very interesting in his university, but he was talking about many schools. And so I said, why? And then we started to talk about the psychologization of our society. The fact that because we have lost some of the big stories, right? The big narratives, the big storytellers of our history was religion. Religion gave us answers. Religion helped us deal with three of the most important aspects of human life, which was how to deal with the incomprehensible, how to bear suffering, and what to do with the questions of evil. When it wasn't religion, it was our ancestors, it was our elders, it was the social hierarchies and the community. All these aspects of our lives are now in our hands. We have to give meaning, create procedures and protocols all by ourselves. And that requires that is what is elevating the psychology, the psychologization of our society. We don't think in terms of values and beliefs as much as we terms in terms of feelings and authenticity and self-expression and things like that. So to have the mental health become mainstreamed has a lot of great things. You know, it used to be very secretive. It used to be shameful. It used to be stigmatized. There's a lot that has happened by making mental health more open and accessible. But on the other end, we are diagnosing left and right. We're pathologizing as so many different things that are actually normal experiences that are part of our human living. And we are putting people often in boxes very early on and keeping them there. And we are weaponizing those diagnoses. And you can basically go on TikTok and establish within a few little videos if your father, mother, brother, your husband, boss is a narcissist. And if you are suffering from insecure attachment. And this is a story too. This is a language with which we are helping. You're no longer a sinner, you're sick. So we are going to tell you what is your sickness. And this is part of the Western culture that we are living in at this moment, and very much focused on trauma, less focused on resilience, you know. And when talking about resilience, we're talking about an individual resilience of a set of traits that are inside of you, rather than our capacity to tap into the communal resources that will help us face adversity. That's a whole different way of looking at resilience. So these days, trauma is very much a central concept of how we are understanding the human experience. But that's the story of today. Sure. And maybe in 10 years, there'll be another story. So you're asking me, is there too much advice? I would say who gives the advice is important. How much do people who actually really have experience remain the authorities on the advice versus finding it, you know, well marketed on social media? And what is the nature of the advice? Is the advice one that puts more burden on the individual and isolates you more and makes you more ashamed if you don't succeed? Or is the advice one that helps us come together and understand that human living is collective living?
I mentioned in my introduction that you are the daughter of Holocaust survivors, and your parents actually met after being held in death camps for, I think, 4 years. Met, I think, on the road. I don't know if that was metaphorical or whether that was physical, but nonetheless, they experience suffering and evil that is hard to even comprehend or put words to. But you also wrote about the fact that they were determined to live, and so many people that survived the Holocaust, you know, survived, but they didn't live. But there was something about their embrace of life. You call it the erotic but the embrace of life that allowed them to live. And I'm thinking of all just the suffering in the world today and what the evil, I think we can describe that as well. And one worries about, especially children, you know, surviving the kind of wars and conflicts that we're seeing around the world. What can your parents tell us, I guess?
What can my parents... No, I'm going to start actually... You know, what would my parents say right now? I have no idea. I think that they have always been very lucid, that there is indescribable suffering and evil being committed, and that anyone can do it, even the ones who think that they're right. Especially the ones who think that they are right. Yeah. What my parents would be talking about is how one guard was kinder than another. And if they saw that you had stolen a piece of bread, they didn't kill you for it. And then my father tried to understand which ones they were. And he would say, sometimes you kind of thought that the kinder one, the one who had a shrivel left of humanity, was the one who actually remembered their grandparents, so that they had seen older people. And they had some kind of heart for the older person versus the young people. He tried to create all kinds of theories, you know, to make sense as to why do people perpetuate and perpetrate. But I think that they would have been alert to the, from Gaza to Sudan to Ukraine to Yemen, they didn't make a distinction. When it was a child, it was a child. When it was a person who was ruthless, it was a person who was ruthless. And they looked for human decency, regardless of the group or the community that you were part of. And that gave me a very universalistic point of view. They also lost everybody. They literally met physically on the road as they came out of neighboring concentration camps. And they understood that a survival was going to be created by having a community, a chosen family, what we call today, because they had nobody, neither of them. They kind of lost 200 people each. Wow. So this notion that you need others to rebuild life and to give life a new meaning and to have a reason to wake up in the morning. When you, this is, happens to be my personal experience, but I think that there are many people who have families that can give them these lessons. The Jewish Holocaust is one. There are many others. And that means that you ask yourself, what makes you wake up in the morning? And when you work with depression or when you work with trauma today, what gives people a reason to wake up? What gives people meaning? What makes them think that their life is worth living? That's the fundamental experience. So today, with all the despair that's going on, there are two sentences that have really interested me. One is a definition of hope, and that it is not about, that hope is about engaging with the plausibility of the possible and not with the inevitability of the probable. And the second sentence that has really helped me is the concept of tragic optimism that Viktor Frankl wrote about, which is that you can't control what's happening to you sometimes, but you do have the fundamental freedom, which is to choose how you will react to it. And that space in between, that ability to maintain a sense of hope and meaning in the face of the tragic, is where I think we are at this moment. And we find it. And this is where my tour coming to Philadelphia becomes so important, is to create what is called experience of collective effervescence, where you create an experience together that gives people a sense of belonging. And that sense of belonging is what makes you feel like you're not completely alone, invisible, and that you matter and that life matters. And that is the loop that I try to create. So it looks like it's a fun first day, 3,000 people tour, where I come to speak with you about love, desire, etc. But there's a next layer, which is what you experience when you are singing together, breathing together, feeling the heat of other people next to you, and grappling with the imponderables of life together. And that is where my parents are underneath. It's invisible, but that's the learning. It's It's how do you breathe in that desire to live and that sense of aliveness in people through connection, intimacy, and fun?
All of that. We are almost out of time here. Is there a brief answer to what your patients have taught you about you?
I think the most important thing my patients have taught me about me is to say, I'm sorry, I made a mistake. I think I went too fast. I think I misunderstood. I'm going to say things I think, but if I'm off, please, please tell me that I'm completely off. I do not mean to be right. You know your life much better than me, and only you will live with the consequences of your decisions. All of that can be put in one word, humility.
Esther Burrell, thank you so much for joining us today on The Connection.
It's a pleasure to be here.
And again, she's the author of several books, Mating in Captivity, The State of Affairs, and she does have a tour. She will be here in Philadelphia at the Met on April 4th, an evening with Esther Perel, The Future of Relationships, Love, and Desire. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of The Connection. Debbie Builder produces the show. I'm Marty Moskowain. Thank you so much for joining us.